Good morning, folks. August the 27th, 2025. We're speeding to the end of August and the beginning of September with the Labor Day weekend this weekend. And the LSU Fighting Tigers will be taking on the Clemson Tigers. Number 9 LSU, number 4 Clemson, Saturday evening game, 6:30 kickoff. I believe Chris Blair will join us at 12:30. We'll break that game down. And we'll talk about the game and a few Katrina memories as well. At the beginning of the noon hour, Greg Rusevich, chairman, Louisiana Board of International Commerce. He's also chaired the Metro Crime Commission, and he was the CEO of Transoceanic Development. During Katrina, we'll talk about the challenges that not only the city faced, but shipping, the port, and others. Philip May, president and CEO of Entergy Louisiana. He's going to join us about this Public Service Commission, which has approved their plan to build new infrastructure to power Meta's $10 billion data center in Richland Parish. One of the biggest projects ever to be undertaken in the state of Louisiana. Something that we ought to be very proud of. We'll talk about what it will take to power that facility. Yesterday, the President Trump, in his cabinet meeting, showed an overlay of the size of this facility, almost taking up the entire island of Manhattan. That's how big this thing is. It is huge. And at 11, we'll visit with Sheriff Joe Lapinto, the sheriff of Jefferson Parish. He will be deploying in September first responder drones. I spoke to him last week, and he was describing to me how this works. Wait till you hear how operationally this is going to work for the Jefferson Parish Sheriff's Office. It is cutting-edge technology. It is huge, and he'll explain what it'll mean to you as homeowners, and certainly what it'll mean to those that think they're going to step into Jefferson Parish and commit some crime. It's not a rosy picture for them. At 10:30, Bo Jones, president and CEO of the Water Institute, which actually was an outgrowth in the aftermath of Katrina, will focus on the model for resilience that came out of that, and we'll spend some time with Bo Jones. Kind of sad news this morning. Actually, very sad news, not kind of. I mean, you know, the fact that we are dealing with the aftermath of this Roseland plant explosion, Smitty Supply, and we find out this morning that the employees are all out of job. They've all been terminated, and they're on their way. And, you know, a lot of these folks helped in the rescue efforts. Some saw what was actually happening. Some helped evacuate their area. No injuries, thankfully. No deaths, thankfully. It's just absolutely incredible. And just days later, they find themselves out on the street. This is probably a pretty good indication that they are underinsured, that they're going to have other financial difficulties. And it's going to be interesting to see where this lands up. Already lawsuits have been filed. Does not surprise me. The fact of the matter is that there's been very little information that has been given out by this company. Obviously, they are huddled up with all of their risk managers, lawyers, and otherwise, because this company is one of the biggest privately held corporations that does what they do. They have other production facilities in other states and other storage facilities in other states as well. So it's just sad for the 400-plus workers at the Roseland plant who are out of a job. Let's move to another issue. You've heard me talk about how the city of New Orleans arbitrarily, I think, and capriciously imposed a fee on the collection of the ad valorem taxes for the school board. And as a result, the New Orleans City Council, appropriately so, I think, in my humble opinion, passed an ordinance that said no more. The city cannot do that. What's interesting, what's become a kind of a bone of contention in the mayor's race, and that's why I say, you know, listen to these folks carefully, right? I don't know about you, but from my seat, following all of the issues that have come out of this debacle of an administration called the Cantrell administration, so many issues that the only people that have really been able to successfully right the ship on some of these issues, not all of them, some are still in court, right, is a New Orleans City Council. And what I find odd is that there are those trying to say that the New Orleans City Council is part of the mayhem, which I think exhibits a little bit of ignorance and is trying to play on the lack of knowledge that voters may have as to the role of the New Orleans City Council being the legislative branch, and that the mayor has all the authority and all the power. And the New Orleans City Council had found themselves in trying to be very creative in how they can address some of these anomalies to be able to take a much more proactive role and to have a chilling effect on some of the craziness of the Cantrell administration. And where that ship has been righted is pretty much been done so by the New Orleans City Council. So the court, they go into court. The administration actually has the gall to walk into court on a restraining order hearing and admit that they were purposefully violating the ordinance that was passed in April, barring them from collecting the fees, which can cost the school system up to $6 million. They actually went in and said, we don't care about that ordinance. We don't care about the legislative branch. We don't care about any of that. We're going to continue to collect the fee because we want to. Now, who's creating the mayhem here, right? How many times have we heard this threat to democracy term all the time, right? Well, this is a classic case of that, right? I don't care what the legislative branch says. I don't care that you're taking advantage of the school system. I don't care that you're making it harder for the school system to make ends meet and that we're sucking $6 million out of there and we've yet to walk into court and provide the statutory authority in order to do so. That is the classic definition of arbitrary and capricious. And they just don't care. So, you know, we'll spend thousands upon thousands upon thousands of dollars that we don't really have, right, litigating this matter because, as was pointed out in an article in NOLA.com by John Stanton today, and he said it well, whether there's a fight remains to be seen. Cantrell is not known for taking criticism or defeat well. And she and her aides have been increasingly willing to ignore any city ordinance the administration disagrees with, forcing the council or others to file suit to try and enforce the ordinances she finds objectionable. It's the same, you know, tactic that she takes when you, the public, say something that she doesn't like, right? She starts doing background checks on you and things of that nature and the whole deal. And, you know, it's everybody else's fault as to what's going on. And I mean, what's really been interesting over the weekend is we have Nagin taken up for Cantrell, right? And all of their problems are created by the media. Now, if that's not deflecting from the underlying human conduct that led to their indictments and conviction in one case and we're starting the process in the other, I don't know what is. Interestingly, tomorrow we're going to go through this with Rafi Goyeneche. We're going to talk a little bit about how the Nagin case came to be. And it might be the first time that this story is told. So stay tuned. It's going to be very interesting. You're going to want to hear this. And you're going to gain a better understanding that this person walked into a place of worship and is attempting to rewrite history and basically mislead the public about what the truth is. Mind-numbing. Unbelievable. Absolutely incredible. Say nothing. Stay wherever you are. If you can't be honest about what was happening, the lack of preparation, and everything else that goes along with that, I don't know what to tell you. So we'll see where this goes. There's a September 4th, I believe, date on this hearing, preliminary injunction hearing. And hopefully we can put this issue to rest once and for all. And hopefully maybe the mayor will succumb and eliminate this or negotiate a more appropriate fee than the fee that's being charged. It's pretty onerous. You know, and we're even having difficulty figuring out how much the revenue department budget is, how much of the money that they're taking from the school system makes up of the budget, so that we can try and put this in some context. You know, it's been kind of a guessing game, and the finance director, Romy Schofield Samuel, doesn't really offer up a whole lot. No big surprise there, because I don't think she has a leg to stand on. But here we are again. We're going to end up fighting about things that we don't really need to fight about and should be pretty easy to resolve. And this is why the city council finds itself having to step in order to attempt to try and do the right thing more often than not, right? They have a lot of other things they would love to be able to address and take care of and look into and the whole nine yards. But no, we've got this sideshow that goes on all the time. Much of it is very freakish in nature. We don't even know why we find ourselves in these positions. But we do, and it continues to be a huge distraction. I wanted to follow up on comments that I made yesterday about the 600,000 Chinese students that the president is now saying he intends to accept into the territorial boundaries of the United States, into our American colleges and universities. Now, what I didn't know at the time, and I know now, is that that number, 600,000, is actually double the number of students that are currently here. Now, we had to listen a lot about homeland security, about the threat to the security of the homeland. We had to hear about laws that were passed in China that basically says that every person in China is a cudgel of the country. And, you know, they have to collect intelligence. It was called the National Intelligence Law, and it was passed in 2017. And Chinese citizens are required to support, assist, and cooperate with national intelligence efforts, regardless of their location. Doesn't matter where they are. They have this affirmative obligation. And you know what happens when they have access to this and others find out that they didn't share this with Big Daddy over there. They get in trouble. They got problems. Many go to jail. We also know that China really relies heavily on a lot of this non-traditional way of collecting intelligence. We had to hear about all of this, testified to by national security officials, testified to by FBI directors, pontificated on by President Trump and his minions over and over and over again. So now that we have had some, I guess, nice communications with China, everything's changed. And yesterday, in that same cabinet meeting, the president began to outline how we're going to get along with the Chinese. And it's just going to have to happen. And we're going to do this. And my suspicion is that maybe he recognizes and realizes that we're not going to be able to stay on the path that we're on for much longer, because some of the economic data is beginning to reveal itself. And it is very fluid right now. And there's a lot of uncertainty as in to what direction it's going to go in. And it's interesting. So 600,000. But what you need to know is that our all-time high of foreign students here was about 1.1 million, right? Now, these are the numbers that are going to shock you. Some universities have extraordinarily high enrollments of foreign students. For example, Columbia University and Northeastern University have student bodies that are 40% foreign students. 40%. 4 out of 10 students there are here on a student visa. Carnegie Mellon has 44% foreign students. Illinois Tech is 51% foreign students. And the big issue for me and the friction point is that whatever happened with President Trump's notion of America first? We have a lot of our kids that would love to go to these universities, but obviously there's not enough capacity. The enrollment, the acceptance rate in some of these universities is single digit. Single digit, but 40% are foreign students. See, they take those out of those numbers, right? They're paying full freight. So this is a financial thing, and it's so much so. And you know that there hasn't been the warmest and fuzziest relationship between the president and these universities. The president said yesterday that if we didn't change this, these schools would go under. If we didn't change this, he said the enrollment cliff that arrives over the next 2 years, it's going to be bad for these schools. They're going under. Now, this is a hell of a thing. We have been investing in these schools and these universities and higher ed in a huge way. We have engaged in exotic financing schemes there, utilizing your tax dollars, and many of you paying this to schools that your kids will never go to. We have developed infrastructure on these universities, and we're sharing the wealth in huge numbers with foreign students. But be that as it may, they have been contributing some dollars as well because they're paying full freight, right? So the ROI, quite frankly, for these universities is far greater to have these foreign students there. But when does it become really a situation where it's harming the ability and the upward mobility of our kids to get into some of these high-performing schools? It's not like we don't have kids that have the grades. We hear stories all the time of students with 4.3, 4.4, 4.5 GPA and a 36 on the ACT, a perfect score. And guess what happens? They don't get in. And then we get the diversity excuse. This is why they're not getting in. No, 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 no. I think it's because we're selling all of these spots, for the most part, to these foreign students. 1.1, 1.2 million worth of these foreign students. And now they want to raise the numbers even higher. Really? I've yet to hear from anyone say, how does that truly inure to our benefit? And what happened to all of these arguments that we talked about for the last 6 months? A couple of fuzzy, nice little conversations with Xi Jinping, and all of a sudden this whole thing changes? The dialogue changed? The paradigm changes? Everything? They promised that they were going to improve their behavior, and now we've taken them off a double secret probation and given them another chance and given them more opportunity to collect more intelligence by doubling the number of Chinese students that are here. Call your Congress folks, call your senators, call your House members, if you feel like I feel. Don't sell us a pig in a poke. Don't have us go down this pathway and then all of a sudden pull the rug out from everyone saying, never mind, don't believe a word I said 6 months ago, 5 months ago. Don't believe what I've been saying about what I have to do. It's actually the opposite, and we're going to double down. I don't know about you. I don't like it. We'll be right back. Welcome back, folks. We are joined by Bo Jones, president and CEO of the Water Institute. Bo, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Noel.
So, Bo, your organization was kind of an outgrowth or in the aftermath of Katrina, right? And if you would, for the benefit of the listening audience, talk about the mission and vision of the Water Institute.
Yeah, absolutely, Noel. You know, I think the easiest way to connect this is to connect the dots to what you were saying yesterday, where you were with Ms. Barnes talking about how, look, you're kind of tired of talking about resilience, as it always seems, you know, that it's a struggle to survive rather than how are we pushing forward. So after Hurricane Katrina and Rita, many in Louisiana, New Orleans, and elsewhere, Baton Rouge, had that same idea, is that rather than just bouncing back, which people are amazing at bouncing back, and you've had some great stories on this week about people bouncing back, the idea was how do we take these incredibly tough life experiences and this existence on a dynamic delta and use it as an opportunity to create excellence in how we plan, how we build, how we connect. So the Institute is an applied research organization that spun out of that idea in 2005. Been around for about 15 years, and our mission is the vulnerability of people, communities, ecosystems, and companies. And so that's what we've been trying to do for the last 15 years. Kind of get started after Katrina.
So if you would, I know you guys have involved yourself in a number of different projects and things of that nature. Tell us about some that you see as emblematic of this forward movement.
Yeah, I think there's the work that we're doing, which I'm super proud of and happy to talk about, but I think things that's important to note is that the Water Institute is one of many organizations, both in the academic research community, the private sector, architecture community, and the nonprofit sector, that since Katrina has not only been pushing back against the problem, but they're trying to figure out how they can help help communities around the Gulf Coast and around the country get to that point a little quicker. So a couple examples, you know, we have had the privilege since 2012 of working on the state's comprehensive coastal master plan, hand in glove with three state administrations now working to help have these comprehensive flood protection, ecosystem restoration services. Today, I'm proud to be a part of the state's hurricane flood forecasting and decision-making system. So with your background, Newell, as a sheriff, you know, one of the things we're doing is working with the Governor's Office of Homeland Security and the local officials to try and not just predict when storms are coming, but then make decisions based upon that. What roads are going to flood? Where do we have search and rescue needs? Where are critical facilities going to be impacted? So we're working with the state there. But then also expanding out from Louisiana and the Gulf Coast, You know, we have been pulled in with partners to communities, Houston, Mobile, Jacksonville, St. Pete, all trying to learn at a faster clip the lessons that have been learned here in Louisiana. But then in so doing, we go to those communities and we learn wonderful things about what they're doing and what they're focusing on, and we bring those back home.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, every time we hit a hurricane season, it's kind of a live science project, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that even in our lifetime, Newell, right, you know, we all in this region, the white knuckles come out in June, and we start up in the tropics. And one of the things, you know, regardless of how you shape it and how you shape it, one of the things that we've learned, Katrina wasn't the first example, it won't be the last. Of our limited ability to look backwards and say, this is what's going to happen in the future. We try. You know, there's wonderful models, wonderful scientists, and wonderful teams looking at the historic data to try and predict what's going to happen in the future. But there are so many factors, so much uncertainty, right? We don't know where there's going to be power to the pump. We don't know what human challenges are going to happen. And so we have to be prepared for things that we expect.
Give me a call back.
Bo, I think what we're going to do is we're going to go to a break. We've got a connection problem here because we keep losing you. We'll be right back. We're visiting with Bo Jones, President and CEO of the Water Institute. Stay with us, folks. We'll be right back. Folks, when we come back after the top of the hour news break, we'll visit with Jefferson Parish Sheriff Joe Lapinto, and we'll be talking about his deployment of first responder drones that are set to take place in the month of September. Where do you hear about this technology? We'll also visit with Philip May, President and CEO of Entergy Louisiana. We'll talk about the Louisiana Public Service Commission's approval of their plan to build new infrastructure to support Meta's $10 billion data center. Welcome back, folks. We are joined by the Sheriff of Jefferson Parish, Sheriff Joe Lapinto. Joe, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Joe, you know, just kind of reminiscing, I was looking at the date, and today was is actually Harry Lee's birthday. He would have been 93 years old today. He was born August 27th, 1932. So he would have been 93 today. Just a little tidbit of information.
Happy birthday, Harry. We miss him for sure.
Absolutely. No doubt about it. Joe, really excited about this topic. I had an opportunity to speak with you the other day. You told me a little bit about what was going on with your deployment of first responder drones that you hope will take place in September. Tell us about this technology and explain to us how it will be deployed.
No, I can't wait. This started probably 5 years ago. Chula Vista, California was utilizing a drone as a first responder. Now, Jefferson Parish Sheriff's Office has used drones for years, probably have 30 in our arsenal. Drones outside Jones, it doesn't make a difference, but they're always line of sight drones where a person, you know, launches the drone from their location, always has line of sight of that drone itself and is able to operate it. In Chula Vista, California, FAA regulations also required them to have line of sight. Well, that was okay for them because Chula Vista, California averages, you know, 62 degrees, 65 degrees a year, and you had someone on top of a roof and they launched a drone. That certainly isn't going to work in South Louisiana. Can't put somebody on a roof to be able to make that happen. But as the technology advanced, we have the ability, from an FAA standpoint, they give you waivers in order to operate drones without a line of sight. So it gives us the opportunity to put 23 drones that will cover the vast majority of the unincorporated areas of Jefferson Parish, including most of the cities in Jefferson Parish also. And we will have them pre-positioned in cooled, heated charging stations on the top of a roof somewhere. And they have a 2-mile radius, so we overlap those drones from different locations of where it is, so we were able to cover the vast majority of the parish. And then we have one room that has the ability to have 4 drone pilots in, so we're listening to radio calls. And so when a radio call comes out, They have the ability to interact with that call. The call goes into the computer aided dispatch system, so it already knows the GPS location, and they say launch. And that launch will launch DFR number 3. Drone is the first responder number 3 would launch and fly autonomously. It knows that we have geofenced all the buildings and power lines and all towers and all that, take care of it, but it flies to the location autonomously without the pilot intervention. And then once it gets on scene, the pilot then basically takes over the camera and puts the camera on what it wants to look at. It has been shown in other jurisdictions that have started to implement this that probably 25% of the calls to service of our road deputies can be marked up by a first responder drone. It also, certainly gives the information to us a lot sooner. And I give the example of the door handle pullers that we know about. You know, door handle puller is out at 2 o'clock in the morning in the 100 block of A Street. Well, by the time my policeman gets there 3 to 5 minutes later, they're not in the 100 block of A Street. I don't know if they're on B Street. I don't know if they're on C Street. I don't know if they got in the car, or I don't know if they're in the 400 block of A Street. But we've got to go locate them. So if a vehicle turns down that street, the burglar just jumps into an alleyway, hides until you drive past, and then they get to keep on going or get out of the area. Well, with this, we put a drone up in the air, all have thermal capabilities. They get to fly above that scene, locate the person before we even put a unit in the area, make a determination when's the best time to go in. When they get into another car, you know what? Now we're going to go take them down. We're going to go surround that car, and the person's not going to know what hit them. And so it gives us a very, very quick response time, but with live eyes on the ground immediately, you know, within a minute or two of launching a drone. Very excited about this.
Now, Joe, Sheriff, you know that you're going to have successes with this because you guys have deployed line of sight already, in certain neighborhoods when certain things are happening, and you've been able to track individuals, door pullers or whatever it may be, and take them down as well, right?
Well, it gives us also, I give a perfect example, obviously, with a bad outcome with the New Orleans East missing child that was found yesterday, right? We had a very similar situation a week prior. It was a 5-year-old autistic, nonverbal autistic female that wandered out of the house, ended up, we got on scene very quickly. I certainly sent our drone teams to that location, but it was still 25 minutes before my first drone team was on the ground to start launching. The child ended up being in a house next door playing with a dog and was safe and had no clue that, 100 people were looking for. But at the end of the day, if we had that drone as a first responder operational, from the moment we get the phone call, that drone is over that neighborhood within a minute. And so we're able to start checking the backyards that have pools in them. We're all, because all of that is manpower. You know, even though you get 20 people on scene, you got to, okay, how do I jump this fence? How do I get around? How do I get in this neighborhood? Who has pools? Who doesn't have pools? We're pulling up Google Maps, right? You know, the drone gets to be able to search those large areas very, very quickly and gives us the opportunity to check those off the list, before a hand-to-hand search code, right? Having that success, we've seen it, but it's always a delay when our SWAT team gets put there or just a drone team or a search and rescue team or whatever the case may be. And this will give that immediate action to be able to be there. And you think of it this way. This is 23 drones that work 24 hours a day. For me to cover a shift, that's 4 shifts. It's an A shift, a B shift, a night watch, and a day watch for a 12-hour shift. So this is, basically 4 sets of eyes that are out there on patrol every single day. For us, it's 23, so that's, 88? 88 sets of eyes for the price of about 10.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I mean, it is absolutely incredible technology. Now, these are camera view style drones only, right? Because I know some of the newer technology, they even have armaments on the drones.
Yeah, they won't have ornaments, although we will have lights on them. We do have the ability to talk on them. We're actually going to have, it, for some reason, it loses connection and can't fly back. It actually has a parachute on it, so we can go get it from that standpoint, although that doesn't happen often. But it also has the capabilities to hook, you know, whether it's defibrillators to it to bring them to remote operations, or even a life jacket. So we'll have a life jacket type of drone out at Bonneville Boat Launch. So anybody within 2 miles of Bonneville Boat Launch, if a boat goes down, I can get a life jacket out to a location very quickly too.
So I know the hope is this will be deployed in the month of September. Is that correct?
They are going to be delivered starting in the month of September. I already have some of my buildings already ready for. We're working on the control center now. I hope to have all 23 by the end of the year, if not sooner. We will have them in stock, but we're working with private businesses and contractors to get all the infrastructure in place that we need to put on each location. But the vast majority of them will be finished before Thanksgiving.
Joe, let's pivot real quick, and congratulations on the deployment and best of luck on the deployment of that equipment. I I'm a tech guy, right? I'm sitting here and I'm a little jealous, Joe. I'm going to be honest with you.
No, I think we all are. I mean, look, let's face it. The days that you grew up in, you certainly before me, but even for me, I wish we had this technology when we were coming up through. I mean, it's really fun to watch. I'm glad I'm being a part of it.
Absolutely. Let's pivot. You'll be sheriff now 8 years in September, and you've already had to face in command of storm response, and we're celebrating the 20th anniversary of Katrina. A lot of chatter, a lot of talk. Just your general observations of preparation, coordination, collaboration.
Well, I think, look, I'm one of those ones that I was on the 9/11, but I graduated law school in December of 2004. So I left the sheriff's office, 8 months right before Katrina, and I wasn't on the job at that period of time, right? But certainly the challenges that you and Harry went through, you've made it easier for me in the future, right? And whether it's the international trucks that we have, where many departments relied off of Humvees that didn't work or anything like that, and now we've been able to not only utilize your international trucks, but replace them with a different. So we have working equipment that goes out to do it. That doesn't solve the day. We can't evacuate 400,000 people from a government perspective. But I think, the older population that was around there in Katrina understands the value of, let me get out of here for this. So our communication system is so much better today, right, than it was back then. So hopefully, if we ever have another Katrina, we still have communications, because that was the biggest issue that you had during that storm. Nobody knew what another person was doing unless you were able to just get in touch with them by, mouth to mouth and say, okay, go do this. And then you didn't see them for several hours before they came back and said, okay, that's done, and you do something else. And so the communication is such a big effort during those times of need. And when you don't have it, it just makes it impossible.
Yeah, no doubt. And, we worked hard in the aftermath of that to have the latest and greatest technology. It continues to improve, and it's a lot better today than it ever was, and to have a level of redundancy. I have often said, Joe, and I want your reaction to this, if you don't control it, it ain't going to happen. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, one of my comments is I only can control what I control, right? I mean, because the fact of it is I don't know when the next homicide is going to happen, but when it happens, I know I can control the response to it, right? And so I agree with you. You can expect somebody else to do it, but don't necessarily expect the outcome that you are looking for or as quick as you want it. And so you've got to have people that are, responded to that, understand that that's the mentality that has to go into any type of operation. This is what we need, and this is what we need to do now. And if you can, understand that that's what it is and have that clear chain of command of this is what the decision is, let's do it and let's implement it, and then we can move on to the next decision. But do it and do it now.
Yeah. Let's finish up real quick. You have your 6-month you know, crime stats. Where do we find ourselves? And if you don't have it, I do. Looking
crazy.
At 29% reduction in murders through the first 6 months, 22% reduction in rape, 34% reduction in robberies, 4% reduction in assault, 1% reduction in burglaries, 19% reduction in thefts, and 33% reduction in auto thefts. 3,429 reported UCR Part 1 crime offenses. If that holds true in the back half, this will be, I tease you all the time, I always dreamed of getting below 10,000. I never did get there. But this will be in the, this could potentially be in the 7,000 to 7,500 range, which is unheard of.
It really is. I don't know how low it can go, Noel. I mean, last year was our lowest year ever, and we are well below those numbers this year. It really is. It's unreal. I mean, I credit our community. I credit the technology. Burglaries that you couldn't solve back in the day, it's because we didn't have the information that we have today. Everybody's got a Ring camera. Everybody's got a camera on the house. So if your house is burglarized, we're going to have a picture of somebody leaving that area. Even if you don't have it in your house, somebody is, right? And so the ability for us to solve crime is so much easier. The amount of things on people's cell phones, you know, gives us the ability to go solve these homicides and have nearly 100% solve rate on them. And so nobody's getting a second homicide or a third homicide. You know, the fact of it is we're solving it after the first, and we don't hear about it again, right? And so it really has drove down those numbers to an unheard of level. We had a murder of a 3-year-old yesterday or 2 days ago, right? I mean, it's unreal. I can't fathom it. But that being said, the numbers themselves, when you just put the number to it, to be lower than we are, we've only had 3 years since going back to 74 that we were in the teens. Both of the other ones were in the 80s. This one was last year was 19, and we're lower this year than we were last year. I'm happy for it, and I'm glad I'm part of it.
No, absolutely. That's when I was looking at the numbers, I was like, oh wow. And you know, one of the most impressive numbers, quite frankly, is the reduction in thefts, because that's a hard crime category to deal with, and it's a crime category that, as you well know, is the largest percentage of the reported crimes to the FBI.
Yeah, I mean, I've tried to do a good job on that to keep that down, right? As you know, that was one that always continues to increase and increase and increase. And one of the ones that we do from that standpoint is we have a very robust ability to really prosecute shoplifters. And these drones are going to help that, too. So now when I have a company that calls and says I have two shoplifters in the building, instead of a unit trying to get there on time before they get there, a drone will be on the scene. Yep, they just walked out the door. Okay, they're getting into this car. This is the license plate off the car. Even if I don't have a policeman on scene, I have information that I get to follow up on. And so we work very well with the DA's office to prosecute shoplifters in Jefferson Parish, and it keeps them out of the parish. It certainly is a large majority of the UCR crimes that exist. But if you can keep that number manageable, you can continue to drive down the number.
Yeah, especially when you see these horror story videos in jurisdictions around the country where they're just bum rushing these retail outlets, you know, 10, 12, 15 kids going in and just stealing everything they can get their hands on.
Well, we had an investigation into a cigarette, distribution center where it was people from California. They literally were coming across country. They broke in and ended up, getting, I don't remember how many cases and cases and cartons of cigarettes. But sure enough, they found out about it the next morning. They contact us. We start looking at cameras. We end up getting them and start tracking the vehicle already in Texas, I want to say like Amarillo. We get in touch with Texas state troopers, and they end up making a stop. We recovered all the cigarettes, made 4 arrests, and all from California. I mean, but within 8 hours of the burglary happening, they were 8 hours away by vehicle, and we stopped them in Texas and recovered everything. It was great.
Those were some of the best days that I ever spent at the JPSO, and I'm sure they're the same for you. When you read that daily report and you can, and your men and women are connecting all the dots and making it happen on a day-by-day basis, I used to love those days.
Fun to open an email. That's great.
So. Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Sheriff Joe Lupinto, the sheriff of Jefferson Parish. Congratulations and keep up the huge success in crime fighting on the streets of our parish. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Sheriff.
We'll be right back, folks. That was Sheriff Joe Lupinto of Jefferson Parish. Stay with us, 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. When we come back, we'll visit with the president and CEO of Entergy Louisiana, Philip May. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We've heard a lot about Meta's $10 billion data center that's being developed in Richland Parish. And just yesterday, we heard during the cabinet meeting, President Trump talking about the massive size of this facility, almost as big as Manhattan itself. And we also know that it's going to require a lot of power. Well, joining us is Philip May, president and CEO of Entergy Louisiana. The Public Service Commission has approved Entergy's plan to build new infrastructure to power the Meta facility, and he's here to talk to us about it. Philip, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us. This is obviously a huge economic win for the state of Louisiana on so many different fronts. And I know that you guys are very excited about working with them in order to make sure that they have the necessary power to get this project done.
Yeah, absolutely. We met with Meta beginning in January of last year, and it came clear that they wanted to be a real partner in how we work to get power that they need and so forth. And what's so exciting about this project is bringing significant investment to a part of the state that really hasn't seen it. We've seen a lot of industrial development in the south end of the state, but not so much in the north end. So Meta's placing a massive investment in the northern part of the state, and they're doing it in a way where they're paying the full cost of all the interconnection necessary to serve them. They're paying for the generation. So the net of this is having Meta will actually have our bills lower than they otherwise would have because of the way we structured that contract, because Meta was truly interested in being a true partner with the state of Louisiana.
That's huge, Philip, right? I mean, that's not a happenstance or an occurrence that happens all the time.
It's never happened in my 40 years that I've worked in this industry. So it's highly unusual, and we're super excited to have them here.
So obviously you have a lot of regulatory hurdles to jump over. It seems as though y'all got through that process. The Public Service Commission approved the plan put forward by your organization, Entergy Louisiana. What will that look like?
Yeah, so what that did is we presented a plan, and then, of course, the Public Service Commission, along with other interveners, took a look at that, and they asked us to make some tweaks and do some additional things in there, which we have done, all which makes the deal that we cut with Meta even better for the state of Louisiana. But, you know, essentially what we're going to do, we're going to build three power plants. Two power plants are going to be right there on the site adjacent to Meta. We're going to build another power plant here in South Louisiana, actually in St. Charles Parish, all of which will produce investment for the state of Louisiana, jobs for the state of Louisiana, and then the investment that Meta itself makes, which they pegged at $10 billion, is going to come with 5,000 construction jobs and 500 permanent jobs. Those 500 permanent jobs are going to have a multiplier effect that will, again, produce essentially 2,500 new jobs in the Richland Parish area. So that investment by Meta, the investment that we will make, will all produce economic benefits, expand our grid, make our grid more resilient, more robust, all of which creates benefits for our citizens of Louisiana.
We're speaking with Philip May, president and CEO of Entergy Louisiana. Up there, too, a part of the infrastructure that's going to, I guess, be improved is your transmission corridors, right, as it relates to these new power plants?
That's correct. So we are building a large number of lines, and for the lines that are directly connecting to Meta, there's more than $1 billion of which they're paying for up front. So we'll get the additional benefit of those transmission lines, and they'll be paying for those directly up front. So our customers won't pay for those. We are building and expanding another line that we were planning to have to expand in 2033. We're bringing that forward to 2030. And so the way that will work, that will be shared with customers, but the upfront cost of paying for that will be paid for by Meta. So the net effect of that is customers will be no worse off. They were going to be paying for it in 2033. Meta will pay for a big chunk of that upfront, so the customers are no worse off. And yet, stronger, better, more resilient grid as a result of these investments.
Got a number of texts, Philip, asking what kind of plants are these that will be generating power for Meta?
Yeah, it's a great question. And when we were working with Meta how we need to do this, it became clear to us the only way to meet their desire to do this quickly was to do this with natural gas plants. So we're building three combined cycle combustion turbines. These will be the most efficient plants on our system. In fact, they'll produce another $100 million a year in fuel benefits for all customers as a result of that efficiency. But Meta also has a commitment to having a clean resources. So they're also going to have 1,500 megawatts of solar available to them to help decarbonize that facility. We are also going to add carbon capture sequestration to one of our plants to reduce the carbon impact of this facility. So it really demonstrates what we can do on a fast scale. It's a tribute to Louisiana working together, but also the additional benefits of cleaning up that energy so Meta can meet its commitments of having clean energy for that facility.
Timing is everything. Time kills all deals. If you're not able to do this and respond in this fashion, they go somewhere else, right?
They absolutely go somewhere else. And as I said, we started meeting with these folks in January 2024. What we learned during the announcement was this was essentially a competition on a world scale. They could build this anywhere. They chose to build their marquee investment here in Louisiana because we're able to respond with speed. And I will tell you, never been more proud of our state, because when we first brought this to the governor and secretary of LED, Susan Bourgeois, it took an all of Louisiana approach to get this done. Local officials, the legislature, the governor and his cabinets, all connecting so we can make this happen quickly. And then the LPSC actually advanced the approval of this to August from October, which is important because Meta is actually, as you mentioned in the cabinet meeting that Trump had this week, he talked about the potential for Meta to expand this project to make it even more of a dramatic investment and larger impacts, larger benefits for our state and our customers.
So let's I know when y'all implement a lot of these changes like this, you look at the infrastructure grid in a way that it helps in more ways than one, right? Were y'all able to take that same approach this time?
We did, and it's able to bring stronger, more resilient lines into the state. It allows us to have higher load serving capability. In other words, the next customer that shows up will get the benefit of that. But in addition, because Meta will be paying for a significant share of existing things we planned for, as you know, we're in the middle of a $2 billion resilience program. Meta joining us essentially means more people will be paying that bill. So it will reduce the cost that customers have to pay for resilience, for instance, by 10%. Same thing for prior storms. We generally bring those folks in and then have to pay for it over a period afterwards. Meta will pay for a portion of that, reducing the cost to our other customers by 10%. So you're absolutely right. It improves our infrastructure, but even better, it allows us to do it at lower cost to our customers.
What I like about it, and the reason I asked the question, is I love when y'all have options, right? Because, you know, as one of my previous interviews today, I said that Mother Nature is predictably unpredictable. And the more options you have, the more tools in your toolbox, so to speak, that you can shift things around and provide power from different directions. And that's nothing but good for us down here. We know that because we were embedded in serious conversations when we lost some of our transmission corridors.
Absolutely. And I think that's a great point, because when we talked to Meta about what we needed to do in placement up north, one of the things we were able to do is look at where our grid had vulnerabilities before, where we needed to improve that, and how we can make it more robust. And one of the things that will come with this is additional transmission lines that create redundancy for South Louisiana. You know, our grid essentially runs close to along the I-10 corridor with not a whole lot of northern input coming into that. So when you have a storm, if it chops into one of those corridors, it puts the grid at risk. By being able to inject more power from the north, which is something we're going to benefit from with Meta, that will allow us to have a more resilient grid when we do have those storms that show up. Because so far this hurricane season has been good for us, but we know that there's going to be another storm one day, and we're thinking about how we make this grid better for our customers.
Philip, I want to hear you knock on some wood right now, okay? This season's not over.
Haven't quite got to the peak yet, but I'll take it.
And, you know, and then the opportunity gain as well, as you talked about earlier, with the possibility of expansion, because the expansion probably is going to increase the need for more power, right? And more options being developed.
Absolutely. It will require a dramatic increase in power. I think Meta has described this as roughly 2 gigawatts, and what they are putting on the table is something close to 5 gigawatts. So more than doubling the size of that, that creates optionality for us to expand the grids in new ways that can create even more benefits for our customers. But you know, the other thing that goes with that is those new plants will create more redundancy, more resiliency, and more efficiency for our existing customers. And lastly, the thing I want to say about this is that having the state be able to move quickly on this is why we, Louisiana, are in contention for one of the largest, most advanced data centers in the entire world. And it says something about what we can do as a state when we are aligned about the outcomes we're trying to achieve.
Absolutely. This is a win-win on all fronts. Final thoughts?
Final thoughts are, look, this is not going to be a lot of work over the next 3 years. But customers should know the result of this will be lower bills than they otherwise would be, stronger infrastructure, more efficient power plants, and more reliability. All things that work to the benefit of our state and our customers.
Absolutely a win-win again. And we really appreciate you joining us. Philip May, President and CEO of Entergy Louisiana. Have a great Labor Day weekend, sir. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, folks, that was Philip May, President and CEO of Entergy Louisiana. This is exciting. I mean, it's one of the biggest projects in the history of the state of Louisiana. And then as he just laid out, Philip May, that is, it makes perfect sense. It creates so many downstream options and upside for us. It's huge. As they negotiated and were thinking through this process, now it's been approved by the Louisiana Public Service Commission, and things will be moving fast. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. Folks, the Katrina story is your story, our story, and the New Orleans story. Friday, on the anniversary of the storm, you can join WWL for a special day-long broadcast featuring Tommy Tucker, myself, Dave Cohen, Scoot, live from the Presbyterian historic Jackson Square from 6 a.m. to 4 p.m. You're going to hear interviews you haven't heard before about the rescue, the recovery, the rebirth of one of America's most beloved cities, brought to you by Lieutenant Governor Billy Nungesser and the Louisiana State Museums. And you're not going to want to miss an amazing free symposium, Living with Hurricanes Katrina and Beyond, reimagined for the next generation, from 10 a.m. to noon. It'll be one block away, right there at the La Petite Theater. It is moderated by Norman Robinson and features the Lieutenant Governor Billy Nungesser, Walter Isaacson, Aaron Broussard, and former Mayor of Lafitte Tim Kerner. Then tour the updated exhibition at the Presbyter from noon to four, free and open to the public on Friday, August 29th. And talking about the exhibit, let's go to Kathy, who has something to talk about. Kathy, welcome to the show.
Hi. I am so proud of my dad. He's Pete Savoy. Everybody knows him. And he had a lifelong fight to close Mr. Go. He believed that the salt water would intrude into the marsh, killing all of the cypress trees, which was our barrier. He went around to all the schools and anything that he could talk, any group that he could talk to, with his display, which is now in the Presbyter. My dad passed away 11 years ago. He got very sick after Katrina. Before he got sick, well, he was on his way being sick, but Carlton Dubichaux brought him in a boat, and he threw the first stone into Mr. Gove to close it. And I'm very proud of him.
Will you be there Friday, Kathy?
I didn't know about this, and I do. I would have to know a time because I could move my clients around. Yeah, I would love to be there.
Well, the exhibit opens Friday, and it's open to the public. It's free. There's a symposium from 10 to 12 that's going to be put on at the Little Theater right across the street from the Presbyter. So come on out, and you'll have the first day opportunity to see the exhibit.
And maybe my brother as well, Steve Savoy, because he lived it with my dad as well. We were all from Chalmette at the time, yeah. So, yeah, everybody knows my dad, Pete Savoy. But his exhibit is there, and I will try and come, and I'll get my brother to come.
Well, congratulations to you and your family, and obviously your dad is in everybody's thoughts. I recall he worked hard. He was serious about it. So, Kathy, thank you for joining us. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. All right, folks, when we come back after the top of the hour news break, we're going to visit with Greg Rusevich during Katrina. Greg was the CEO of Transoceanic Shipping. We'll talk about the trials and tribulations of Katrina. And welcome back, folks. We are joined by Greg Rusevich. Greg was the CEO of Transoceanic Shipping during Katrina, but he has been involved on so many different fronts in the city, to include parish chairman of the New Orleans Crime Coalition. He was chair of the Metropolitan Crime Commission and also chairman of Louisiana Board of International Commerce. He is heavily engaged in a lot of things in the city, and obviously cares a lot about the city and cared about the rebirth and the reengineering of the city. And he joins us now. Greg, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Duel. Thanks for that really kind introduction. Thank you for that. Very kind. Thanks.
Greg, so take us back. You're the CEO of Transoceanic Shipping. You work a lot, you know, relative to the port, the importance of SAME. We hadn't heard from a lot of folks about, you know, port activities and shipping and what that meant in the aftermath and the challenges in the aftermath of Katrina.
Yeah, well, there are two things. One, in terms of the port, you know, the port was one of the first operating entities to come back, and really Gary LaGrange played such a critical part, he and his team coming back at the time. And really, we had to have the port open just like we had to have the airport open, because that's how goods and were being delivered, and that's how supplies were being delivered for the recovery. And so the river was absolutely critical, and the port was absolutely critical. Obviously, in terms of our own shipping activities and everyone else's shipping activities from the private sector, they were very limited, naturally, and we had to find other ports to really have commerce to use. But Newell, what it really led to, because as we came back, you know, a group of our all, you know, the business leaders that came back at the time in our own specific spheres, in mine, commerce and shipping, but we really had to figure a way to rebuild the community. We really put, frankly, more time not only into rebuilding the businesses, and we all had great teams that did that, But really, we had to focus on the rebuilding of the community. And that's really, looking back at Katrina, what was so special to me is building those relationships and building those coalitions that really helped, I think, rebuild the city at the time. Because as you remember, we had a lot of divides. There were a lot of racial divides, a lot of ideological divides. And to me, it was really about figuring out a way to move those aside and focus on what the critical issues were and just keep it issue focused and then build multiracial coalitions to attack the urgent needs in the city. So from the private sector, yes, Newell, I mean, the ports, shipping, my own company, we came back, you know, we really made Houston our hub until we were able to fully bring everybody back, and which we did. But really what became the focus was really a dual vote, and it was, you know, 20-hour days because you were both running your business, but at the same time bring the community back, because if we didn't bring our community back, we had no business. So you had to figure out a way to get the education system back in line. We, in my case, to really help on the criminal justice situation, Rafi was a big part of that, Rafi Guarnacci, playing a role in it. We had to bring the economy back. Michael Hecht played the critical role there. All of the pieces. And then we had to build coalitions multiracially, because that we had to find ways to make sure that the Urban League and the Business Council and GNO Inc. were all working together, and the Black Chamber and the Hispanic Chamber and the New Orleans Chamber were all working together. And that was one real challenge, and one that I'm very proud we got through in flying colors, and you know, had a beautiful spirit of working together. And it was all about focus on issues, specific issues that were addressing us. None of this historical divide or ideological divide. We left all that at the doorstep and just focused on what was the best for the quality of life for the citizenry, all citizenry.
You know, for me, from my perspective, I think there were some people that were focused on the divide. They kind of even wanted the divide in many respects. But there was no game plan. Nobody had ever gone through this before, right? So there was not a script to follow. And as people, you know, I remember being involved in a bunch of these meetings. I know I was in meetings with you and law enforcement. The JPSO did a lot for the NOPD. It's not often talked about. But it's amazing how much, you know, the men and women of the JPSO covered for them in retrieving bodies, setting up the DMAT, setting up disaster mortuary, disaster medical assistant teams, and the like, even down to giving the NOPD 200 weapons because most of their equipment was destroyed.
Huh.
But it seemed to me that a lot that went on was trying to figure out, and I recall the conversations, how was government going to be financed, because there was no tax base. And they, you know, there was a big concern. I know from my perspective as the tax collector, I kept telling folks, you better figure out how to get some business, you know, and micro business centers around the city back up and running so that you have a revenue stream coming in. Because at some point, that federal spigot, they turning that sucker off. And if you don't,
right,
if you don't get this
right
started, we may not recover, you know. And it was that uncertainty, not having a script, you know, that I think people were thinking out loud, and some folks were getting punished for it, quite frankly.
Well, right. And the city government was totally unresponsive in the years following Newell. And not only that first year, but the first 3 or 4 years following Katrina, the city government was completely unresponsive to the needs of the citizens of New Orleans. And what happened is that it was unresponsive to all citizens. So businesses needed to have a safe place that their employees and their families could live, work, and run a business. And at the same time, you know, people in other parts of the community needed schools they could send their kids to and be educated. They needed safe neighborhoods, which they didn't have. And it was affecting everything. So I would walk into meetings, and we realized that we had to build coalitions. And I would get regularly together with Dr. Cowan, you know, Mike Cowan, who is a great civic leader and still is. And Mike had an umbrella organization called Common Good, which was very interracial and very faith, you know, faith leaders were involved, all the interracially in every way, shape, and form. So we reached out to that group through the Business Council and business groups and GNO Inc. and Metropolitan Crime Commission, and all came together. And, of course, you had the same thing, Newell, where there was one part of the conversation that wanted to talk about, you know, structural racism and wanted to really talk about the historical divides. And we made a very conscious decision, all of us together at that table, except for the outliers, that we were not going to do that. Instead, what we were going to do, and we've kept that going to today, we were only going to focus on issues, specific issues that were holding the city back, and fix those issues. And we're able to all come together and say, yes, this is what we need to do on crime. We have to have more cops. And so, for example, when we said we have to have more cops, there was one part of the community that said, yes, but we want them in our community. And we said, great, we want community policing. And then we said we need more prosecutors. And we actually went to Washington to get funding for additional prosecutors because the DA's office was completely, you know, there were no prosecutors. So we got funding for prosecutors. And at the same time, one part of the community said, well, if you need more, if you get more prosecutors, we need more public defenders. And we said, great, we agree. Let's improve the whole system, get more public defenders and more prosecutors. So we were able to have that balance, Newell, and people of goodwill can find balance and find agreement. And we were able to do that. I think much of that lives on to today through the NOLA Coalition and through others that we sort of started building the foundation back then for. So I think that was one of the key takeaways, that when we find things that we agree on instead of big things that we disagree on, we can get a lot done. If we get stuck in the mud debating long-term historical issues and divides, we get nothing done. It's best peel back the issue, get the facts of the matter, and then go fix the issue as a multiracial coalition. That, I think, has been the key to any success that the city has had over our recent years and since Katrina.
Yeah, there's no doubt, and there's so many things that you know, are big and better, obviously, since that point in time. And then there's still the underbelly, right? The challenges that we're still facing and some of the stuff that we can't seem to get out of our own way.
Yeah, and I think that's we're back to sort of where we were in terms of an unresponsive city government. So obviously that's front and center now in the mayor's race and in the council races. What we need is back exactly where we were. We're not as quite as severe. You can't meet the tragedy of Katrina or match it. But we're in many ways back to where we were. You've got an unresponsive city government. You have a you know, so many areas of city governance that just don't work and is not serving the people. And it's not serving any of the people. So it's not again, it's colorblind. It's every neighborhood. It's not working from St. Charles Avenue to the 7th Ward to the 9th Ward. So, you know, in the French Quarter, even, that needs to be cleaned up and needs to be safe. So you've got these elements across the city that we had back then. And we need that playbook once again to just focus on what is best way to fix these issues. And we must have city leaders that are accountable and responsible. And you remember we had Fall New Orleans that we launched, Newell. And Fall New Orleans is a way to really make sure that the political leadership is keeping its word and meeting its promises and mandates. And that's all through coalitions and making sure that they're pledging and keeping those mandates. So we have to hold the political leadership accountable. And one more point, you have to be regional in your thinking. And we've lost that, too. You bring up a really good point about the way the JPSO helped NOPD, saved NOPD at the time. And we can learn so much regionally, and we have to work together more regionally because that has really stopped the last 5 years, 8 years. And so we should be using one another's best practices and approaching matters regionally. Every issue we approach, we have to approach it regionally. I mean, crime is just one example where technology works across boundaries. And obviously, cooperation between federal, state, and law enforcement, local law enforcement, regional law enforcement has to work together. So we need to really tear down the boundary lines and be working as a regional group as well. We can do a lot more regionally than we can in a silo.
Obviously, I think that's compelling for the next 20 years, because my next question to you is going to be what you think the biggest challenge is moving forward, you know, in the next 20. I mean, I think in a lot of respects, we've moved forward. We've made significant gains. We've kind of diversified our economy. Not as much. It's never as diverse as you want it to be, right? But we've made some significant strides there. Got some big projects, not only here locally that we're working on, whether it's Venture Global or if you're thinking about the LIT, the improvements in the port, what's going on down there along the Convention Center Boulevard with that project. But the next 20, because we still have this big challenge of out-migration, population loss. I say this all the time. I think you agree with me, Greg. We need to move from a third tier to a second tier city. And that's about people. And we find ourselves in a situation we need more.
Yeah, we've lost a dramatic. We were just in a meeting yesterday. We've lost a dramatic. The stat I saw, we've lost 10. New Orleans has lost 10% of its population over the last 10 years, which is, I think, the largest of any city, metropolitan city across the nation. Regionally, we've lost about 4%. Those are all dramatic numbers, particularly the New Orleans number. And I think there are two things we need to do, and I'm not just the only one saying this, Newell, but it's really prevalent in the business community and every conversation I'm in, is really two things. Number one, fix the quality of life issues. It's unacceptable that the quality of life issues are not fixed. And it should never be accepted to just be mediocre. So we have to strive for excellence in everything in quality of life issues. Every issue across the city needs to be fixed. There's no reason for it not to be the critical issues I'm talking about. That's number one. Number two, connected directly to that, is we need to really have an attitude that appreciates business. I mean, businesses are the ones creating jobs. So you talk about the River District. You talk about Shell that's putting its headquarters down there. Right at the center of the River District, you have Entergy that's supplying energy. They're the only Fortune 500 company that's still here. You go across the board. Yes, we need to hold the corporate community accountable, but we also need to understand they are who brings the jobs. And so we need to be very. We need to figure out a way to make this a place that appreciates business, that rolls out the welcome mat for new businesses. And that finds out what we can do. City leadership needs to be understanding from the better dialogue with the business community of what the business community needs in order to build and prosper here and grow jobs. Because if businesses build and grow, what happens? The jobs occur, additional jobs. And there's been a historic tension here between the business community and a city hall, which is absolutely unacceptable. So whatever candidate is really the friendliest toward a business is really equaling friendliest toward jobs. And you can rant and rave against businesses all you want, but they're the ones producing the jobs. So if you want jobs and you want city finances, you need to be demonstrating appreciation and cooperation.
Isn't it funny that we don't view government as a business here? I mean, because one, if you did, you would be focused on revenue enhancement, right? And revenue enhancement would be drawing new businesses to this place, having a larger population base, more property taxpayers, more sales taxpayers. Right. You would have a strategy around that. And we just have this kind of disjointed approach, and we don't want a right-sized government at the same time. So we're not going to cut, we're not going to enhance revenue, and we really believe that we're going to succeed in status quo? I don't know of anybody that succeeds in status quo.
Exactly. No, and that's all the cities are making the tough choices. They don't go through this. The other cities that are prospering You know, we're going to have a significant budget deficit in the city next year, and I haven't heard anybody talk about where the cuts are going to come, but they're going to have to really, and the way to do that, Newell, as you know, is take your priorities. We know what the top priorities are. There's been polling after polling showing those priorities. Make sure those are completely funded. Crime, streets, sewage, make sure all the infrastructure, make sure those are funded. And everything else, you're just going to have to make difficult decisions in, because businesses cannot pay and people can't pay more than they're paying right now. They're already, it's already running people out of the city. So if you look at models like Charleston and Tampa and Nashville, and we can name them forever, Austin, those cities are all growing and they're making tough decisions. They've got good cooperation between their city government and the business community. They're figuring out a way, ways to grow jobs. They're figuring out a way to grow the tax base, and they're very responsive on governance issues. So if there's something that the community, that citizens are not receiving, those city governments go in and they fix it. So they don't tolerate a street, you know, lack of street repair and not, you know, a French Quarter that's our crown jewel not being spick and span and safe as can be. These are just obvious things that are not, that we debate, that we shouldn't be debating. And so we have a long way to go, Newell, but I do think that that spirit from Katrina, we need to get that spirit back and be working together multiracially, be focused on the issues. Everyone agrees that jobs are critical. Jobs are produced by the private sector, by businesses. Everyone agrees that we need streets that need to work and drivable streets. Good schools, playgrounds. Nord is another example that's been completely broken. We have to fix Nord completely and just find the best way to do it, private-public model. And just things need to be fixed. And then, well, I think we can get ourselves out of the hole and at least get back even to Tier 2, as you said, and then we can build from there.
You know, in all those cities that have redefined, re-engineered themselves, what I think the common theme that I see, it's not always worded this way, but you set the bar and you're not willing to accept anything less, going right to that word that you said earlier, attitude.
Absolutely, and a sense of urgency toward it, a sense of urgency, pride, and thriving for excellence, and not accepting anything other than excellence, no longer accepting mediocrity.
Music to my ears, my friend. Greg Rusevich, thank you so much for joining us. Keep up the great work. We appreciate it. We are very lucky to have you, and have a great Labor Day weekend.
Thank you, Newell. You too. Thank you very, very much. You too. Thank you.
All righty. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We are joined by Chris Blair, the voice of the LSU Fighting Tigers. Chris, welcome to the show.
Newell, great to be with you once again. It's finally here. It's game week, man. We're just a couple of days out from kickoff.
Man, I can sense the excitement in your voice, Chris.
I'm ready to go. Ready to go. Let's get there. Saturday can't get here quick enough.
Absolutely. The number nine LSU Fighting Tigers take on the Clemson number four Clemson Tigers. Not unlike all other SEC stadiums, that's not an easy place to win in.
No, it's not. You know, I worked at Clemson for five seasons way back when, and, you know, they got a great tradition there. And, again, they like their Clemson football, and certainly can't argue with, for the most part, Dabo Swinney's tenure there as head coach. Certainly from about 2014 on, they suddenly took a major step forward and played for titles, won a couple, and, again, typically are in the mix. I know the last couple of years, probably for Clemson standards, or at least the current Clemson standards, maybe not as as well as they would have liked to perform. But, you know, talking to people I know there and just watching the media, obviously a number four preseason ranking, they're going to be excited about this year's team. I'm not sure yet if it's quite the talent on paper that some of those teams have with Deshaun Watson and his college career, and obviously Trevor Lawrence, who LSU defeated in the title game in 2019 there in New Orleans. But I think the optimism is there. So Dabo Swinney called for an orange out Saturday. So looking to see a lot of purple and gold kind of break up all that orange when we get to Frank Howard Field Memorial Stadium on Saturday night.
What do you see as the big challenges for LSU?
You know, I think it's going to be the run game again. I mean, obviously, I'll talk about defense in just a little bit, but I think LSU, you know, with the offense they have, which at times was very prolific. In fact, you can go back, you know, the last couple of years, and obviously Jaden Daniels, when he was the quarterback, he kind of was the runner in the run game. You know, and that's not Garrett's style, but I think, you know, there's some good running backs LSU has, and I think to really open up the playbook, LSU's got to be efficient running the football. I mean, just imagine, not that you're going to run on every first down, but if you do and suddenly you're looking at second and three as opposed to second and 10 on an incompletion, suddenly your playbook opens up. And, of course, Garrett's got plenty of great weapons around him, both, I think, at running back as well as the wide receiver and tight end position. So I just think it opens things up for you. So to me, offensively, I think LSU's going to be fine. They got great playmakers wherever you look. You know, it's a new offensive line, basically, replacing Will Campbell and Emory Jones. But I think running the ball will just make things so much more dynamic for this offense. And the big question, obviously, is defensively. That's something LSU has struggled with the last couple of seasons. You know, there were games they had to outscore people to win. There were games where they just couldn't do it, and they couldn't stop the opponent. You know, a couple of games last year where dual threat quarterbacks, ran rampant. You know, Klubnik averaged last year about 33 yards a carry. He's a dual threat. He's got the ability to do it. It's not as if he's, you know, going to be out there running around like Jaden Daniels did. But I'm sure Clemson, you know, paid close attention to the film from last year for LSU on their inability sometimes to be able to stop that type of attack. So I think defensively, with the playmakers they brought in, some of the younger guys that got thrown in and baptized by fire last year, I expect LSU's defense, and you can hear Coach Kelly each week this season during fall camp and leading up to the game, really feels like this defense has taken some major strides forward. So to me, those are the two things. Can we run the ball offensively, and can we get back to the type of LSU defense that this school, this program, and certainly these fans are accustomed to?
The SEC season is a tough one, right? And, I mean, it's tough from the very beginning, and you always have to be focused on depth. As we look at this year's team compared to last year's team, both offensively and defensively, your thoughts about depth? I thought last year we couldn't end up outscoring a lot of people because we had a little bit of a depth problem, in my view. I don't know what your thoughts are, but how do you see it this year?
Yeah, I think Coach Kelly has said that. That's kind of stood out to me just listening to him over the last several weeks and months, and that's about depth at some key positions. And, you know, it certainly starts at the offensive line. While you lose those two heralded players I talked about, you know, Braylon Moore comes in. He's kind of settled things down as center, transferring him from Virginia Tech. And when you talk to the coaches, they kind of talk about how maybe you don't have, at least yet, that individual standout that you had last year. But as a team, as a total unit, this may be a better offensive line. He's talking about rotating, you know, as many as 6, 7, 8 guys on the offensive line. I think that probably will be the early part of the season, because I think eventually, barring injury or just giving a guy a breather, you want to kind of get some continuity there, and I'm sure that's what they're going to do. But, I mean, the fact that they've got that type of bodies that not only are listed as offensive linemen, but they feel pretty good about what they do up there. That's just one area. I think the defensive front, with the addition of Jack Pyburn from Florida and Patrick Payton from Florida State, Jacobian Guillory coming back after being injured last year, now all of a sudden you're talking about some really key names along with other transfers on that defensive front. So you're looking at the tip of the spear, both for offensive and defensive lines, that, again, it goes to a lot more depth than we saw last year and certainly the year before that, and certainly in Coach Kelly's first year. The wide receiver position, which has been phenomenal really for a long time here at LSU, is almost laughable, the abundance of riches they have. I mean, I've talked to a lot of people across our league, and they feel like there's 7 or 8 guys that they're going to have to rotate at that wide receiver position that would play a lot of snaps at a lot of SEC schools, a lot of Power 4 schools. So, yeah, I think the depth is why this team on paper, again, I like to say everything on paper until you get on the field and the lights come on, the crowd's there. I think this is why it's the most talented team Coach Kelly's had, and he's been saying that for quite a while now.
Last year's defensive play, with some of the challenges they had on the defensive line, it seemed that it put a lot of pressure on linebacker. And there was a question as to whether or not we really had the speed that we thought we had. But I'm hearing a lot from Baton Rouge this year that they feel like defensively, this is one of their fastest defensive units. Is that true from your perspective?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I believe so, having seen practice. I mean, they're flying around the football. And I thought it was interesting, you know, a couple of the sessions that the media has been able to take in. You know, one of the things I hear from them is, wow, the defense is really kind of stingy out there when they go 11 on 11 or even 9 on 9, which, you know, all of a sudden there's all this worry about the offense. I think the offense is going to be just fine. I think that's a better sign for this defense being able to cover the field sideline to sideline. And I also think a lot of times last year at the linebacker position, you were asking those guys to actually break through the line of scrimmage to get to the football. I think that, you know, again, relies on your defensive front to be able to allow the guys like Wes Weeks and Whit Weeks and even Harold Perkins Jr. to make those kind of plays, that they're not fighting the defensive front or they're not fighting a running back. They're chasing the football. So I think there's improvement across the board, Newell, to be honest with you, defensively, from a personnel standpoint, from a depth standpoint, and a talent standpoint. And that even includes the secondary, because I know they've been much maligned, and at times deservedly so. But I think Coach Corey Raymond is getting DBU back where it needs to go. They've got young players who last year, as I said, got meaningful snaps and meaningful games, and they grew up a little bit on the job. They also went out in the transfer portal, number one class in the country, according to those who follow it. And they got some guys who can go out and cover now man-to-man if you need to do that. It's complementary football. If your defensive front and your linebackers can wreak havoc at the line of scrimmage and in the offensive backfield, that's going to take some pressure off the back end of your defense. Likewise, if they can cover man-to-man and they can lock down on these receivers, it's going to give more time for Harold and West and Jacobian and Jack Pyburn and those guys to get to the quarterback, maybe, you know, get that sack total up, maybe get that strip football up a little bit. I just think the entire package for Blake Baker, whose philosophy is to attack after and try to disrupt these type of high-powered offenses, I think he's got the thoroughbreds now that will – I don't know if it'll be exactly where we want it to be week one, but I think we're certainly headed in the right direction.
I hope, unlike last year, that we start from the very first minute. We seemed to get into a routine of starting slow last year.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I think that's something Coach Kelly's talked about as well. I mean, it's you got four quarters of play. It's a 60-minute game. There's no reason to kind of get acclimated into the game, you know, your second or third drive or your second or third drive out there defensively. So, and really, I've gotten the sense since early January, and I've told a lot of people this, and Coach and I talked about it last week on a show, it's really hard to delineate the end of 2024 and the start of 2025. I mean, that the work was being done when the clock hit zero in Houston last year. And a lot of it has all been centered around that sense of urgency, not only week one, but snap one, game one. And if you were around the football building the last couple of weeks, there's no doubt in your mind that they've got an important game coming up on the 30th against a top five team. I don't want to say that they put all the emphasis on the opening game of the year, but it's pretty daggone close.
Yeah, when you follow up, you know, with a game against Troy, right? I think is that at Troy or is it?
Yeah, are you talking about LSU? We got Louisiana Tech.
No. I mean, I'm sorry. I'm looking at the wrong schedule. That's Clemson. I'm sorry. I apologize.
No worries.
What is the follow up game for the Tigers?
Home opener, Louisiana Tech Bulldogs coming
Louisiana
down.
Louisiana Tech, that's it. Yeah, okay. I put it around here somewhere. I can't find it amongst all the papers. You talked about the receivers, and I was talking about speed. I've heard folks say that this could be one of the fastest receiver corps that they've had in a decade.
Yeah, these guys are lightning fast. You know, I mentioned the abundance of riches. You got a healthy Chris Hilton Jr., who played sparingly for the most part at the end of last year, who had a little bit of rust. And, you know, I always talk about guys who come off injury. There's the physical part of it, and then there's the mental part of it. What can I do? When do I feel like I'm 100% confident that my legs, my arms, my midsection is going to allow me to perform the way it did prior to the injury? And I think that takes some time. Chris is good to go. He's an absolute burner. Aaron Anderson, who I think has improved his speed, is probably one of, I think, for the last couple of seasons, one of the more underrated receivers when you talk about guys in the SEC. I think he's a great possession receiver for you, and he can you know, wander around the field and give a target to Garrett. You go out in the portal, you get Nick Anderson. That's kind of his MO, is an absolute speedster, to let him streak right down the seam. And so I think, again, not only has LSU's offense got a returning quarterback, I think you've added to the weaponry he has with Berrion Brown from Kentucky. As I mentioned, Nick Anderson. Kyle Parker is healthy, who I think he's got a bright future ahead of him. Jelani Watkins. I mean, the list goes on and on, not to mention whether or not you're going to go with Bauer, the tight end transfer from Oklahoma, which is a little more like your traditional tight end, or Tre'Dez Green, who is almost uncoverable from a defensive perspective at that tight end position as maybe really an extra receiver. I think Garrett's going to have the ability to stretch the defense when he wants to. He's going to have the short stuff to dink and dunk if they need it, and he's going to have the intermediate passes. And he's got great players at all of those levels offensively.
And is there someone new joining you in the booth, Jacob Hessler?
Yeah, he joined us last year. He'll be back season. Yeah. So, yeah, happy to have number 18, Jacob Hester, in there with us, along with Gordy Rush on the sidelines. And I'm sitting here right now trying to get everything ready, so we'll be ready to go when boot meets ball Saturday night.
All righty. Chris Blair, the voice of the LSU Fighting Tigers. Can't wait to listen to you on Saturday night, man. Thank you so much for joining us. And have a great weekend. Bring home that win. No pressure. Just bring it home.
You got it. As always, thank you, Noah. Always appreciate chatting with you.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. Folks, we are going to have a special edition of the Port of New Orleans show tomorrow with both Beth Branch, the president and CEO of Port NOLA, and Michael Heck, president and CEO of GNO Inc. And we'll be talking about the importance of the Louisiana International Terminal. So we look forward to that tomorrow, and that'll be an interesting conversation to have both of them. And we're just going to have a rambling conversation about a number of the important issues relative to that project. And you still have a chance to win a portable generator. We're now right in the midst of the hurricane season, and we know everybody worries about losing power. WWL wants to help ease your mind, so we teamed up with Craig's Electrical and Generator Service to offer you the chance to win a portable generator. We're talking about a Generac GP6500 portable generator. I've seen this thing, folks. It is unbelievable. Total value, almost $1,000. You can enter to win once every day. So start now. Go to WWL.com/contest for your chance to win backup power from Craig's Electrical and Generator Service, because when the power goes off, Craig comes on, and WWL, Louisiana Official Emergency Management Station. So don't forget about getting in there and getting that done. And we're also going to have our segment with the St. Tammany Economic Show with Lacey Osborne, CEO and president of the St. Tammany Chamber of Commerce. A lot going on in the North Shore as well. We'll be right back, folks. Check in with Scoot when we return. Well, folks, we covered a lot of territory today. I hope you enjoyed today's show. That segment with Sheriff Joe Lapinto relative to deploying first responder drones. That is absolutely incredible. Really excited about that, and totally excited about the LSU-Clemson game this weekend. So glad to have college football starting, and Scoot joins us. Scoot, were you yelling from your balcony that Taylor Swift got engaged?
You know, I'm excited for her. I mean, this seems like a true love story. I mean, you know, it might have been kind of a publicity thing in the beginning for both of them, understanding that the, you know, the publicity spike was good for both of them. But that might have been fun, but I think they truly have fallen in love. So I'm really very happy for them. Charlie Kirk, the conservative host, has some really interesting advice for Taylor Swift. We'll talk about that. Also, Remembering Katrina 20 Years Later does continue with Kermit Ruffins and a few others on the show today, and we'll talk about that shooting at a Catholic school in Minneapolis.
Scoots headed your way, folks, with a great lineup. Stay tuned. Hope you enjoyed today's show. Have a great Tuesday evening. We'll see you tomorrow.